Stay tuned for a Juno Afternoon. Ray Vitick will be here with details about an upcoming workshop on building healthy families. We'll hear an audio postcard produced by Quentin Chandler when dozens of people answered an invitation to share art and discuss racial justice and violence at the UAS Rec Center this last Sunday. We'll continue our series on summer fun activities with John Neary, director of the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center, and we'll talk with Carolyn Brown, president of the local League of Women Voters. That, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more live at 3 on KTOO, repeated at 4 on KRNN, and online via KTOO.org. We're next, live. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Democrats on Tuesday nominated Hillary Clinton for president at their party's national convention in Philadelphia. The move, making Clinton the first woman to win a major party ticket, came after a state-by-state roll call vote for Clinton and Bernie Sanders. Many emotional Sanders supporters watched as Sanders called on the convention chair to select Clinton as the nominee of the Democratic Party. Sanders supporters from the Crow Nation of Montana are not quick to back Clinton. Ray Pepper says she came to the convention because of Sanders' commitment to veterans and Native American issues, and adds Clinton has not won her over.
Well, I feel like she needs to be more receptive to Native Americans. During her campaigning, it's Bernie Sanders met with all the tribal people. She has not made that effort at all. Hillary needs to step out to Natives and talk to us about what she wants to do for us and what we can do for her.
Montana State Senator Sharon Stewart Paragoy echoes Pepper's sentiment.
As a Native American, I'm very disappointed with the Hillary campaign, and that for us, Bernie Sanders came to the state of Montana, and it was largely Native Montanans for Bernie, but no such visit by Hillary. It's up to her. She wants our votes, then she has to come to. It's about time. She has to earn the votes.
Stewart Paragoy says she appreciates Sanders' platform on Native Americans and his recognition of tribal sovereignty. Lisa Blackhorse, chair of Arizona's Democratic Native American Caucus, says Clinton has a long history with Native Americans, which she says includes outreach during Bill Clinton's presidency. Blackhorse says she does see the division between Native American Sanders supporters and those backing Clinton for president.
I don't have the clear message because I think it's going to take some healing, but we have a short window to get this message out that, yes, you know, I don't think any candidate is perfect. I don't think any of us are perfect, but I do think Hillary has the experience. I think she has the knowledge, and I think she has enough as being a woman and knowing some of her history that she can stay tough to get things done and carry on what Obama started.
Blackhorse says she understands the frustration and disappointment of Sanders supporters, but hopes they'll vote for Clinton. Hillary Clinton is scheduled to speak at the Democratic National Convention on Thursday. A publication by the American Indian Alaska Native Tourism Association is intended to help travelers on Route 66 learn about tribal nations located along and near the historic highway. American Indians and Route 66 features tribal stories from Chicago to L.A. The highway, commissioned in the 1920s, has long connected travelers to Native nations. Amy Awanape discussed the guide at the start of summer in Albuquerque, New Mexico. She says it's partly intended to help break down stereotypes about tribes by sharing their cultures and histories.
We want to make sure that tribes surrounding public lands have their voice brought forward. It's something that hasn't really been done in the past, and like this book points out, there is a lot of misconception about the American Indian along Route 66 because of the teepees. You know, there are teepees in the Southwest, which really aren't, that's not part of the tribes here. Secondary is to drive tourists to tribal destinations so that the tribes benefit from the tourism coming along Route 66 and that they're able to see where these tourist destinations are located, and to help tribal economic development.
More than a dozen Native nations are featured in the publication, which can be found at tribal locations and visitor centers along Route 66. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kowanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support by the year-long celebration of Native American artist Lloyd Kivanu at the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture, the IAIA Museum of Contemporary Native Arts, and the New Mexico Museum of Art. Info at nmculture.org/LKM. And by Humboldt State University's online Master of Social Work program, which focuses on decolonizing work with rural and indigenous communities. Applications accepted August 1st to 31st at humboldt.edu/social work.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And welcome to a Juneau afternoon. I'm Lori Scandling in the studio with our producer, Jeff Brown. Taking a quick look at the weather, well, I guess the best I can say is take a look at the weather. Literally, look at the weather, and you'll see what it's doing. It's going to keep doing that for the next few days, looking at a possible break with partial clouds probably on Saturday. Otherwise, dress for the precipitation that we'll be experiencing. Glad to be here and glad to have with me Ray Vidic as well as Joel Webb, who are with Christ Community Ministries. And we're going to be talking about an upcoming workshop on building healthy families. But my first question to our guest this afternoon was, is Christ Community Ministries a church? And the answer is no. So Joel or Ray, please tell me, what is this organization and what is its mission?
Christ Community Ministries is a 501c3, and our mission is to unite the community of Juneau and to be the go-to for all churches if they want to become as one body, so to speak, across the city.
Joel, how does that work? We have a variety of faiths and actual places of worship. What does the Christ Community Ministries offer these organizations?
Well, I think when something's sponsored by one body, church body in general, that we tend to sometimes associate it with everything that comes with that denominational identity or church identity, which can be a barrier to some things. And so Christ Community Ministries has a wonderful chance to come together among a variety of particularly Christian churches in Juneau and provide a basis from which people can cooperate together to do larger ministry outside the walls, the traditional walls maybe of just one church.
You say primarily Christian. Why not other faiths which also hold a single higher power?
That's a great question.
Didn't mean to stump you, just curious.
Well, I think as we engage as Christians in our culture, as we hold on to that identity of who Jesus Christ is, we have a particular perspective on things. But it doesn't mean that this particular event, Building Healthy Families, and why we're here talking about it, we believe it would have a value to people from a variety of faith perspectives or people who don't claim a faith in a higher power, perhaps. So rather than coming at it from a single church identity, we're coming at it from a broader base. And while the event itself will reflect a Christian perspective on an issue, I think it reflects a broader variety of issues that we're encountering as a city and as a culture in general, you know, including what does it mean when technology becomes so personalized? What does it mean when children grow up in an era of personalized technology that's at a level that we haven't previously experienced as a culture? And that kind of brings together a variety of issues in one thing here. And I think it's a great conversation for us to have as a community. We're coming at that conversation from a Christian perspective over a particular issue, and our faith informs that perspective. But I think it's a question that faces all of us, regardless of our belief in a higher power or not. And so I think the Christ Community Ministries aspect of it is we can come at it from a broader base, without reflecting the particular, maybe more focused identity that may come from one church background.
Thank you. Ray, you helped found this organization. Why?
For the simple reason that to unite the community and to bring people closer to a walk with the Lord. And that's the foundation of where we started, but this event has taken us to a new place, and it's helped us to see. Certainly, we don't want anyone not to come to this event because, quote, it's God is part of this event. That's much the perspective is much broader than that, and that's the real reason. We see the internet as You know, it used to be you could go to get a hard copy of one of those magazines that only men would want to look at. You had to go in the liquor store to the top shelf. Well, now our 7-year-old has that book right in his hand, only he doesn't know it. And it's so easy to stumble into that and then get sucked in. And so certainly, you listeners out there, please don't shy away from this event because, quote, it's Christian we challenge you to think about your families and their health and to know that we are bringing the world's best team in education about this particular subject. They've got years of experience. They have a depth and a breadth of knowledge that far surpasses any organization that I've ever seen in the world, probably.
So the Republican Party at its convention adopted as one of its platforms, as you may know, this concern with youth being exposed to pornography. And the average age at which youth can be and typically very likely will be exposed to pornography vis-a-vis the Internet is age 11. I think you referenced that in what we can call other eras. One might have chanced across one's father's somewhat racy magazine, but the kinds of images that apparently are available and very explicit are much more readily accessible. Ray, talk for just a moment about what is this event that you are referring to and the organization which will be facilitating it. Give us some nuts and bolts, please.
The event is called Building Healthy Families, the Shield Against Pornography, and it's at Centennial Hall. We wanted to do it at Centennial Hall so that everyone would feel comfortable in coming. So it's not at a church, and the information that's being given is for the entire community of Juneau. And there are 5 sessions, 4 on Saturday and 1 on Sunday at Zonta Kahini in the afternoon. We have on our website is all the information that anyone would need to be able to access the dates and times and locations of the events. On our website, we have a list of the 5 sessions and a brief diagram. We also have a index that shows a timeline for every event and what time. The event starts at 9 o'clock on Saturday.
This coming Saturday?
The 6th.
The 6th, yes. So in about 10 days?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah. And then it ends on Sunday at 2 o'clock. I believe it's 2 o'clock at Zonta Kahini with a wrap-up. The sessions cover a broad spectrum of what every adult or every parent or every older teenager needs to know and understand about how pornography can invade one's life and the steps that one can take to understand why it does and the endorphins that come from viewing pornography. That's covered in Brain Basics, which is our first session. And then the second session is family dynamics, practical steps and strategies that can help young adults move into sexual health and help students. And part of when you're soaking yourself in the Internet on 3 or 4 hours a day, and believe me, it's happening in Juneau, what happens is your addiction has you. And the shame and the guilt that you carry with you grows as your addiction grows. And this is a way of helping you understand how that dynamic affects your family. So, and then the third session is parenting in a digital age. So that's anytime, anything, anywhere. It's now a reality because of the Internet and the smartphones. And it's a dangerous one at that. And we want to prepare the next generation, and the most powerful tool we can give the next generation is not protection, but education.
It sounds like people will be expected to take all 5 sessions. Is that what the intention is?
Well, they build on one another, and that's
okay.
A great question. It's an educational process, and we want to equip every parent in Juneau and give them the tools that they need and access to the tools so that and believe me, there's a lot of parents that are faced with this. They find their child and it's on his cell phone. What do you do? Who do you call? Well, there's no hotline for this in Juneau, but the team that we brought is the hotline. They got your back. All you need to do is make a phone call and they can help guide you through the process to whatever access, to whatever materials or help that you need in order to find healing in that situation.
And what is this team you've referenced?
The it's the organization is called puredesire.org, puredesire.org, based out of Gresham, Oregon. Their founder is Dr. Ted Roberts, and Ted was a fighter pilot. He's got a crazy fun story that he tells and about how he was, you know, he was addicted to alcohol and sex and being a tough guy. And he tells a story about how things changed and how he learned how to fight this battle, and then he eventually became a pastor. And he said, I want to have a church where we're not afraid to deal with the things that we need to be dealing with. I want to help my church heal. So there are very few, pastors that have the, or those in churches that have the moxie to face this challenge head on and speak about it openly in a congregation. It's probably the most difficult topic that anyone would have to speak about.
What's the website where people can take a look at the different sectionals and decide if this is something that's right for them?
Thank you. It's our website. It's www.christ-community-ministries.org.
And again, I'll ask the questions. Can folks attend one of the workshops? Is that okay, Joel? I see you nodding your head.
Yeah, it's an all day 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Centennial Hall, and people are welcome to come for. It's free and open to the community, and people can
come as they please.
And everyone who comes, and we've ordered the first 500 people that come, will get a handout that is a synopsis of every session. They'll be given the tools that they need in order to carry that forward, and should they ever run into a problem, they'll have a toolbook.
So as one of the things I've noted as a former educator is that neural pathways in the brain, actual structures of the brain, are reshaped as youth repeatedly watch a series of whatever it is, whether it's pornography or whether it's other things on the internet. Is that brain development and the long-term effects on the brain, is that part of the series that will be discussed?
It will be, yeah. Time Magazine did an interesting cover story a couple months ago where completely from a non-moral value perspective, there's groups forming on the internet of people who are attempting to step out of the addiction because they grew up from age 12, 13 years old, spending many hours engaged in viewing pornography. And they got to the point where they wanted to have a real relationship with a real person. And their testimony is what the story they would tell about themselves is that they were, when they met somebody real, they were incapable of forming and consummating a relationship because their physiology, their desires have been so shaped by the electronic medium that actually engaging with a real person was difficult. So I think beyond even the faith perspective, we see the evidence of what happens to the brain when these powerful forces are shaped by however we engage them.
We're talking with Ray Vittick and Joel Webb, who are with the Christ Community Ministries here in Juneau. That organization is sponsoring a 5-session series of family-oriented workshops called Building Healthy Families, Shielding Families Against Pornography. That is the weekend of August 6th and 7th. 4 of the sessions on Saturday will be at Centennial Hall and the wrap-up on Sunday at Santokahini Middle School. All sessions are free. If you would like to know more, look at this website, christ-community-ministries.org, to see the full schedule. Again, it is free. How about a phone number if somebody has some questions? For example, are children invited or is this for adults only?
Well, that's a great question. We call it PG-13, but it's actually, I would say, PG-16. Unless 16 or older, unless someone is, they're like 14 would be the, if someone's parents been talking to a younger child and they understand what it is, then a 14 would certainly be, that's our limit.
A phone number, if folks want to discuss this with you before they come, what's a good place for them to contact to have a conversation?
We were reluctant to give out a phone number because it's everyone's cell phone number that's on our board, and we don't have a go-to phone number for our organization.
Okay, so check out the website. Go ahead, Joel.
And there is an email address on the website.
As long as there's a contact.
Great. That we can answer questions from.
Okay.
They can email. It's bhfjuno@gmail.com.
Is that a B as in boy?
B, yes. bhfjuno@gmail.com.
Great. Thank you, gentlemen, for sharing this information with us and bringing the program to town.
You're welcome, and thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 27th of July, 2016. It was on this day, 1789, the Department of Foreign Affairs was created in Washington by President Washington, which a couple of months later was renamed the Department of State, and he appointed Thomas Jefferson as the first Secretary of State. Jefferson, who disliked the formality and the elaborate social codes of European courts where diplomacy was conducted. Jefferson, who wrote, "Commerce with all nations, alliance with none, should be our motto." It's the birthday of Joseph Mitchell, born Fairmont, North Carolina, 1908, a writer for the New Yorker magazine for many, many years, writing about people living on the fringe in New York City, gypsies, alcoholics, homeless, fishmongers, a band of Mohawk Indians who worked as riveters on skyscrapers because they had no fear of heights. Joseph Mitchell interviewed criminals, evangelists, politicians, celebrities. He said he was a good interviewer because he had lost the ability to detect insanity. It's the birthday of Elizabeth Hardwick, Lexington, Kentucky, 1916, author of many books of fiction, who in the early 60s met with her friends over dinner to found a book reviewing journal called the New York Review of Books, which she said was dedicated to the unusual, the difficult, the lengthy, the intransigent, and above all, the interesting. It's the birthday of the novelist Bharati Mukherjee, born in Calcutta, 1940. She said, "As a bookish child in Calcutta, I used to thrill to the adventures of bad girls whose pursuit of happiness swept them outside the bounds of social decency." She went to college in Calcutta. After graduation, she asked her father if she could go abroad and study to be a writer, and then she would come back home for an arranged marriage with a nuclear physicist of her caste and class, and her father agreed to that. She went off to the University of Iowa, the Iowa Writers' Workshop, started dating a man named Clark Blaze, and after just 2 weeks, they went downtown during their lunch break and got married in a lawyer's office above a coffee shop. She wrote, "The 5-minute ceremony suddenly changed me into a transient with conflicting loyalties to two very different cultures." Here's a poem for today by Thomas Moore, "The Last Rose of Summer." 'Tis the last rose of summer left blooming alone. All her lovely companions are faded and gone. No flower of her kindred, no rosebud is nigh to reflect back her blushes or give sigh for sigh. I'll not leave thee, thou lone one, to pine on the stem. Since the lovely are sleeping, go, sleep thou with them. Thus kindly I scatter thy leaves o'er the bed, where thy mates of the garden lie scentless and dead. So soon may I follow, when friendships decay, and from love's shining circle the gems drop away, when true hearts lie withered and fond ones are flown. Oh, who would inhabit this bleak world alone?" The Last Rose of Summer, poem by Thomas Moore. That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, a monthly devoted to discovering and publishing new voices in poetry. More at poetryfoundation.org. And by Lumosity, brain training developed by scientists and game designers who turn cognitive research tasks into challenging games. Learn more at lumosity.com. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support comes from Northern Audiology and Hearing Services, providing services for identification, evaluation, and rehabilitation for individuals with hearing difficulties. Located in the Jordan Creek Center. Information at 789-6780.
Thanks for staying with us this Juno afternoon. Lori Scandling here with you, as well as our producer, Jeff Brown. Well, dozens of people answered an invitation to share art and discuss racial justice and violence at the University of Alaska Southeast Student Recreation Center in Juneau last Sunday. The event was organized by two local artists, Christine Nami Erickson and Melissa Garcia Johnson. It had three parts, a visual art exhibition, live performances, and a group conversation on race relations. KTOO's Quentin Chandler produced this audio postcard.
My name is Christine Nami Erickson. I'm an artist, an activist, and a community organizer. Today we're welcoming what we're calling a creative conversation around racial justice and anti-violence for our community. We're calling it a creative conversation because we think there's a lot of ways that people can talk about race, talk about racism and racial justice, and talk with each other, and we're choosing to do ours today through art.
Brown and black. And black and brown bodies on the color wheels and straws and speakers wash it over me. This is the baptism I've been waiting for.
That is from a playwright. His name is Darren Candy.
Let me stay right here. Keep me here. Someday I will die, and I want it to be on the dance floor.
I think he was just trying to give examples of what's going on out there, you know, how people are dealing with things, what's going on in their personal lives, you know.
In my poem, I talked about the way that I love my father and that the way I love my brothers, and that there's hundreds of thousands of people who love their brothers and fathers that way too, and that it's so easy for someone to extend that to someone who doesn't know that person.
All my life, I'll write love letters to all the dead black boys I've never met but have somehow always known. And black women taught me how to love like this, how to howl our lost baby names at Ivy League realities until the politically unhumble marble crumbles. And I'm not saying I want to live in rubble, because we are in America after all, land of the free, if only in fallacy.
Racism is alive and well, and it's as simple as that. I mean, that's the root of all of this.
I'm really afraid of fear itself. Police have got to be less fearful of the guy on the street, and we got to be less fearful of the police.
I feel at a total loss how to proceed and make any difference in the world to make it change.
How can I make a difference? We make a difference by saying to our own peers, that's not acceptable to say that. That's not acceptable to be anti-gay. That's not acceptable to call Obama a porch monkey. And then we need to stand up for others when we see them being disrespected or hurt. We need to stand up and put ourselves right in front.
My name is Chris Sell, and I'm a lieutenant at the Juneau Police Department. There have been incidents across the country that have concerned people about police use of force. I think that that's something that if people have concerns, we need to drag that out and talk about that, because we only function if we respect each other. I felt people look at me. I'm here in uniform, and there was this desire deep down that maybe I want to withdraw. Maybe I feel like people are looking at me as the enemy, like they're seeing me as the police, not Chris, who shares a community with them. And that defensiveness, that desire to withdraw, I think comes up in a lot of people in a lot of situations, and we can't give in to that.
Thanks to Quentin Chandler for that audio postcard of the conversation this last weekend at the University Campus Rec Center. I'm Lori Scandlin on Juno Afternoon, continuing the program today with John Neary, who is the director of the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center, and this is part of our Summer Fun Activities series, and it's been fun to talk to the various people in this community who work with activities that are open not only to the million tourists who show up, but to the locals, and I'm one of those who participates in this fun activity, and that is the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. Welcome to John Neary. He's been the director there for 3.5 years and 35 years total in the Forest Service, which has involved a lot of fun things as well. You worked out at Pack Creek, and what are some of the other positions that you've had, John?
Yeah, thanks, Lori. It's great to be here. That's true. My previous position with the Forest Service as backcountry manager, wilderness manager, was largely on Admiralty Island in the Kootsnuwa Wilderness, which is really Kootsnuwa, as the Angoon people would say. And, I just loved working on cabins and trails for years with my crews and starting that Pack Creek bear viewing area back when Stan Price was there with his stick and the bears. And also Tracy Arm and Ford's Terror, the sea kayaking ranger program. We board ships, we monitor emissions, we did a bunch of other great things down there.
So we're talking about probably the number one visitor attraction in the state of Alaska. Would that be accurate, the Mendenhall Glacier?
I'd say it is accurate, especially if you say on a square foot basis. I mean, Denali gets more people, but they also have about 100 times as much space. So, yeah, we got 550,000 people just between May and September of last year, and we expect to have more than that this year.
What do folks do besides walk up to the visitor center there? What is there to do at the Mendenhall Visitor Center? I usually take off and do the East Glacier Trail, but tell us what there is to offer for locals, for example.
Yeah, so you're very common then for locals because they tend to want to use that East Glacier Trail, in part because it's not as popular as the Nugget Falls Trail, especially if you're there during the busy part of the day, especially when there's five ships in town. So East Glacier gets a lot of attention from residents, and it deserves that. It's a great hike. Nugget Falls Trail, however, is clearly the most popular trail in the Tongass National Forest. I think it's probably the most popular trail in Alaska. And the reason I say it is because we get up to 6,000 people a day at the visitor center on our busy days, and I would guess about half of them want to go to Nugget Falls Trail, and most of them do, especially when it's not flooded, like it is, has been this weekend. We had to close it because the lake level rose and the rain fell, and we had to close it.
Those are some of the hazards, as well as the jollop.
Yeah, right.
Eucalyptus. Sure that right. So that's when the ice dam breaks, and then there's flooding in the lake and
Glacier
the river.
Glacier outburst flood, exactly.
Yes. So have the bears been active this year? I know last year we had an encounter in the spring, and it's because Mom was with her cubs traveling up the hillside there. Haven't seen any myself this year, but I think those fish are coming back up Steep Creek now. Is that the right time?
It is. Last Thursday we first started seeing them, and then Friday as the rains really set in and Steep Creek rose its level, the salmon just seemed to know very quickly and flooded the creek as the lake waters were flooding. So there are now hundreds of salmon in the creek. It's great salmon viewing, except it's a little murky right now with all
the rush of water.
Heavy rains. But the bears know, and of course they've been down trying, but not very successful, I have to say, because the water's too deep.
Too deep, sure.
Yeah. So we're seeing bears every day, but it's still very spotty because they're basically just seen crossing the road. They disappear, they come out, kind of look around, and then they're gone again.
What's the best time of day? Is there a best time of day, or is it the luck of the draw?
Really, it is luck. I can't say there is a best time. There's probably a common misperception that the bear viewing would be better when the tourists leave. Bob Armstrong thought that too until he did a little study a few years back. He actually noticed the bears appeared right about the same time as the first buses started rolling in the morning. And so we conclude that the bears there are pretty well adapted to people, that they know how to move around people pretty well, just like they do in downtown Juneau, and they figure out the routes and the times. And we also know that the biggest danger probably is just crossing the road. And if we can figure out how to get them across the road safely, especially the little cubs, then they'll do just fine out in the forest and stream edges. So time of day is really whenever you can, you know, and best time might be the evenings because there's not as much traffic, so it's just a little calmer. But I've seen many, many times where middle of the day was really some of the best bear viewing of the day.
We should clarify, Bob Armstrong is a well-known nature, primarily bird photographer. I saw him on the trail just the other day. So speaking of using the trail, I noticed this year for the first time that a charge is expected to be paid for parking. Can you talk about that a bit, John? Is this new? And what areas is there a cost associated with?
Yeah, so parking remains free, as does any driving on the road, as does any walking on the sidewalks, as does walking most of the trails, including the most popular Nugget Falls Trail. All that remains free. The East Glacier Trail that you love, that's free. The Trail of Time, the Powerline Trail that gets to it, both free. The Marine Ecology Trail, still free. The West Glacier Trail, still free. None of those require passes. The places that do require them is the visitor center itself, as it always has. The restrooms, that's new. The pavilion, the covered area near the last parking lot. The photo point trail, which is the paved one. And the Steep Creek Trail, which is the bear viewing platform. So if you want to use any of those specific places, that requires a pass. And yes, they're $5 per day, maybe if you're a tourist coming in for just a day. But I don't imagine any Juneau residents would wish or want to pay $5 a day, because there's a season pass, which is usually $15, but just a couple weeks ago it went down to $10 for you plus one other person. And, of course, if you're 15 and under, you don't pay anything.
And or if you're 62 or older, you can get a Golden Park Pass.
Exactly, yeah.
Which is good on federal lands.
Exactly.
Not just parks. Yes.
That's right. Parks and forests nationwide for $10 for the rest of your life if you're a senior. And I'd also throw in, if you're a fourth grader, there's a free pass for you. Of course, you don't need a pass if you're fourth grade, right, because you're under 15, but it gets in three of your family members for free. So
all 10-year-olds who are listening right now, you can
get
three family members in for free.
Yes, and it was so fun because Lori Lamb, one of our employees at the visitor center, was walking up the stairs a few weeks ago, and she heard a really excited voice behind her, a small voice, and it said, "I can get three family members in for free just because I'm a fourth grader." You know, it's just really cool.
There are some benefits, apparently. Is this fee structure new?
Yes and no. The new part is that we're charging for areas outside the visitor center. But, of course, we've charged for the visitor center itself since 1999.
And how much is it to get into the visitor center itself?
Same fee. Everything
$5.
I just described to you,
okay,
includes
and
the visitor and all
that.
How
do you enforce it? Do you, are your park rangers, your Forest Service seasonal staff stopping people, asking them if they have a stamped hand? Or how does that happen if folks are wandering around outside?
Yeah, so enforcement, I like to say, is like enforcement on the highways. When you come to work, you don't really expect to get stopped by a police officer and ask for your license. But if you do something wrong, you probably will be. And so enforcement is a bit like that. It's also a bit like a fishing license. I've lived in Alaska 35 years and have fished every one of those years. I've never been asked for my fishing license, but I get it every year because it's the right thing to do, because I know it goes back to preserving king salmon stocks and improving fisheries. It pays for an agency, which is important, so I get it. And our process is a bit like that. For those who do things wrong, we will certainly make sure that they're meeting the requirements of the pass. Commercial operators are doing quite well in meeting the requirements, and we're watching them closely. For individuals, we're not stopping and checking everybody. We're interpreters. Our job is to connect people to the place, not to make them feel more distant by being cops. So we leave the enforcement to the people with the guns on their hips, and that's random. It's intermittent. So chances are pretty good for most people that they wouldn't see that.
When you say enforcement with the people with the guns on their hips, are there rangers who carry firearms?
Yes, you wouldn't call them a ranger. They're a law enforcement officer. They're the ones that would deal with the tough stuff that we have to deal in the national forests. And they're out there, of course. There are people that are dealing drugs. There are people that are, you know, doing all kinds of things on the national forests. And those guys have to have the guns for it.
How many enforcement officers are there? I guess I was unaware that there was a cadre of such officers.
That's right. The Juneau District typically has two, mm-hmm. sometimes three.
And that covers a big area, I would guess.
Huge area, one of the largest national forests, you know, and the largest district on the largest national forest. So they've got quite the challenge reaching any of the remote parts of the district. So they do cover the road system reasonably well, and they cooperate a lot with both the city and the state troopers.
So speaking of things that people probably shouldn't be doing, there are persistent rescues off of West Glacier Trail. I've talked with Juneau Rescue folks, and that is the most common call in the summertime. My understanding is that the Forest Service has not marked that trail because they want to discourage people from using the West Glacier Trail. Can you help us understand that, if that is accurate, and how the Forest Service is helping or reacting to the number of people who get lost out there and need help?
You know, parts of that are accurate in the sense that the troopers tell us it is the most rescued trail in all of Southeast Alaska, an average of a dozen rescues a year, mostly in the summer, of course. And the part that isn't quite true is that the Forest Service doesn't want to mark it because they don't want people going out there. And the truth is that we know people are going out there. I was out there last Thursday, so I could see them. We also permit guides to take people there, and those guides are taking people in the hundreds. These are people that are going well prepared, though. They're going by boat on the lake, or if they're going overland, they know the route, and they have helmets. They have micro spikes for moving around on the glacier. The guide carries ice axes. They have emergency response techniques that they practice. But I also saw last Thursday when I was up there, Juneau residents who came with no micro spikes. They just had tennis shoes. They were crawling across the ice. And the one woman was saying, I can't believe my, you know, so-and-so brought me here. I almost killed myself on the glacier. And then they entered into the cave, which the traditional cave is crumbling at this point. It's going to collapse at any time. It has rocks that are falling regularly on the entry, and they walked right in. And the guides are all avoiding that cave because it's so dangerous. So you see the predicament the Forest Service is in is that there is a well-known attraction that is now globally famous. Everybody has splashed Facebook and all kinds of social media sites with their beautiful photo of themselves in the back of the ice cave and that beautiful blue ice all around them. So naturally, everybody wants to go out. And we can't put up gates. We can't put
what
a gate in front
signage?
Of it. There is signage. There's a trailhead sign that warns of the danger. There's another sign on the beach that warns of the danger. We put out regular PSAs and articles and stories.
But
and
the route
course,
itself is not signed.
No, because the route itself is changing every day. And that's the key point, is that we have the West Glacier Trail that people use to access the area in general. And that's pretty well maintained and getting better all the time. But people take various routes where they dodge off that to get down to the glacier. And it's not too hard to get down to the glacier, right? Because you got this big white thing that you're pointing at. But then when they get there, there's some really interesting scree slopes to get down that can be kind of dicey. And then you got the glacier itself to cross a bit of to get to the cave. All that presents dangers. But even worse so is after you've finished and you turn around and start heading back, you're just looking at this vast green alder scrub zone or this
rocky
terrain that looks like a moonscape. And there's cairns everywhere that have been placed by various people and flags that go in all kinds of directions. So it's pretty common for people just to get the wrong route. They really need a GPS track that they can follow.
And a guide, probably.
And a guide. That's what we're saying is go with a guide, go prepared. And what does a guide mean? Well, for a Juneau resident, they're not going to employ above and beyond, you know, who takes people from the cruise ships. But they can go with someone who they trust is well-prepared and competent with the route. And when I say well-prepared, if your friend doesn't tell you that you need a helmet and that you should have micro spikes and trekking poles and perhaps even an ice axe, then they're not a competent guide because that's just needed.
Thank you for that clarification. So, John, you've been with the Mendenhall Visitor Center for 3.5 years after many, many years in Southeast Alaska doing a variety of other activities. What's something that would surprise local residents about the Mendenhall Visitor Center area that you'd like them to know about?
Well, you know, we flood regularly. And the thing about the floods that we know about these yokelups you brought previously is that some of them are happening because Suicide Basin empties out very suddenly after building up water. Many probably don't realize we just had another one the other day, just last week. It started on July 20th. The lake went up to 8.5 feet, and we had to close Nugget Falls Trail because as soon as that gets up above about a 7.5 foot lake level, and you can watch this on the web at NOAA's website, which is called the Mendenhall Lake Hydrograph. Just Google that, and you can watch this. And if you see that climbing, and it gets up around that 7.5 foot lake level, you can be sure that the Nugget Falls Trail will probably be closed soon after. Why do we close it? Well, actually, most Juneau residents could probably wade through in their rubber boots for another foot or so, but we see that because of these thousands of people that come wanting to hike that trail, that even a little bit of water forces them off the trail into the surrounding vegetation. So we have denuded trails creating denuded vegetation. So we're trying to really protect those lichens and those mosses from thousands of feet trampling them. So we close it as soon as it gets wet enough that most people start moving off the trail.
Good advice. Keep an eye on that NOAA website. Then we're talking with John Neary. For the last 3.5 years, he's been the director of the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center, and this is part of our summer fun series about fun things to do in Juneau. And I can attest that is a fun thing to do. Thanks for joining us, John.
Thanks very much, Lori.
This is Bird Note. In the southeast corner of Arizona, a cactus wren sings in an open stretch of desert. The roads are dusty, the mesquites scraggly, but in the distance appears a dense grove of trees with lush green foliage. How's this possible? It's an oasis of sorts, made possible by what in the southwest is called a tank, short for stock tank or watering tank. A rickety windmill spins in the hot air, powering a pump lifting water from far below ground to fill a large rectangular pond, dug out by a rancher and enclosed by earthen walls. In much of the southwest, water is scarce. Native habitats endure just fine, but when ranchers add livestock, they have to provide a reliable supply of water. A man-made oasis for livestock becomes an oasis for bird life as well. The sweet song of a blue grosbeak carries from a shrub near the tank. A flash of red marks an aerial sortie by a vermilion flycatcher. A hooded oriole, a bright orange beacon, sings near its sack-like nest in a palm. And when a steer wanders by for a drink, a green heron flushes from the water's edge to take shelter in the trees of the oasis. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Such a lovely sound. Thanks for staying with us on a rainy Juneau afternoon on this Wednesday. Lori Scandling with you here. In the studio is the local president of the League of Women Voters, Carolyn Brown. I should say Dr. Carolyn Brown. As she is a retired OBGYN and a longtime member of the League. I was so glad to have you with us.
My pleasure.
It being an election year. Of course, the League of Women Voters started after the enfranchisement of women vis-a-vis the 19th Amendment in 1920. What is the League doing today to stay relevant? And what are some of its activities in this very amped up election year?
Well, it varies by where we all live, but I focus, since I'm the president this year, on what we're going to be doing here and hoping it feeds out into the rest of the community. We're basically interested in three major areas. The first is voter registration. The second is voter education. And the third is voter participation. Now, each of those has its own labyrinth, its challenges, and its great challenges, I must say. In terms of the voter registration, it's fascinating to people, and I didn't believe it when I did the stats, that voter registration in our community, 91% of the people eligible to vote are registered. Can you believe that?
I do. I guess I would have to say I do, having been a former voter registrar. I guess the question is, of those, how many vote?
That's correct. Okay, that took me even longer to dig up those stats. And fortunately, Lori Sika at the CBJ municipality, and then I did some census web studies to try to get an idea. And I went back from 2000 to 2015 to try to say, okay, of the people, we have the population, we have the eligible voters over 18, and we know how many votes we had out of that population. If you can believe it, our range was from 19% voter turnout to 44% turnout.
So never over half?
Boo hiss, yeah. Not good. And, of course, when we have presidential years or we have hot topic initiatives, we get a little better turnout. But still, our average turnout is 31%. Now, if you do the math, you take all of the eligible voters and you say 31% of them turned out to vote. So 31% of the eligible people in our community, and generally speaking, are deciding for the 100% of us who are eligible to vote.
I know that one of your life's passion is, in fact, greater engagement in democracy and the civic affairs. Tell me why people don't vote.
I can only tell you what they say. And it varies from older people to younger people, to college people, but I've heard these kinds of things. I don't vote because it doesn't matter. My vote doesn't count. We have an electoral college. So in red states or blue states or whatever states you want to be in, purple states, it's a done deal. And as people in Alaska have said, by the time our votes are counted, it's a done deal. So why should I vote? What difference does it make? So that's one thing I hear. College kids, believe it or not, when we registered voters out at the UAS, will say, I'm not going there. It doesn't make any difference. You people don't speak for me, so I'm not going to do it. Then another one, which is very interesting, which is another passion of mine, when SB 91 was passed this past year, and I know it's a little bit volatile in terms of what we're trying to do with it, in terms of people who are prisoners and who need some help when they get out. Well, one of the passions of the League of Women Voters has been felon suffrage, because we believe when a person has done their time and is finished and can walk out the gate, then we ought to allow that person the right to vote, as about 14 or 20 states in our country have now done. Had a man, several people come to me when I was doing registration, and we were hawking the registrars when they would come in to see if we could get them signed up. And this man came in, and I said, would you like to register to vote? And he looked at me, and his eyes were real sad, and he says, no, I'm a felon. So he couldn't vote. So one of the things that we've been studying in the League, and we've just finished a 2.5-year study on this, is the proposition that when a person has finished their time, they still have some probation and parole, but we will discount that in terms of their ability to be able to register to vote, because we know that if that happens, 20% recidivism will go down 20% if those people are enabled to become part of the community and to register to vote.
But Alaska does not currently allow that.
No, you have to go through the whole enchilada.
Well, this could be very dispiriting news that you've just shared. What does and what can the League of Women Voters do to address what appears to be some voter apathy then?
Voter education. Now, how do we do that? We do it through the media. We've been working with the newspaper and other entities to try to figure out ways to get people to say their piece, to write letters to the editor, to write on my turn, to give their opinion, because we cross-pollinate our views and our opinions, and then somebody picks that up and says, oh, yeah, or no, I don't agree with that, and this is why I don't agree with it. Well, this is incredibly educational for all of us to get different viewpoints. Certainly going to the candidate forums, of which the League of Women Voters is extremely involved. We'll be holding one in September at the CBJ. And there will be other debates and other forums throughout the community. We certainly encourage people to go to those. One of the things we do is we go into the high schools and we talk with the government teachers and we have classes with the students. And at one of our last forums last year, we engaged the students to learn what's a mayor, what's a city manager? What do they get paid? What do they do? What difference does it make? What is their differences? And that was during that time when we were voting on our mayor. And then we encouraged
election,
the students to write some questions down for them. And they did write those questions, and we took them straight to the CBJ, and those were part of the questioning for that night. So that's part of our education, too. And then we hope to be able to write more letters to the editor, more op-eds, so that we can cross-pollinate our different ideas. Our libraries are full of wonderful books on both sides of the divide about the progressives and the conservatives, and we encourage the people to go there and to search out those books.
So I should disclose I'm a longtime member of the League of Women Voters, probably 30, 35 years. In that time period, the national membership has dropped by nearly half to about 50,000 nationally now. How is the League trying to stay current with the interests of today's voters?
We have a brand new CEO, a chief executive officer, who's just come on. The other person had been there about 15 years and had carried along with the great swell of what we had done. People have so many things to join, and they get so involved in their own bubbles and in their own little silos that we tend to forget that we've got to open the windows to our silos and pop the bubbles and cross out. So I think there will be a big push now at the national level to reengage the women of this and the men, because men can join the League of Women Voters too, want to mention that, so that we will increase our membership. But it's quite true. We do have about 55,000 members, but we have a large number of donors and people who are not card-carrying members, but who still do the work, do the support, and do a lot of the work for the League. In Alaska, we have about 250 members. We have four leagues scattered between here and Anchorage, Tanana, Valley and Fairbanks, and Kenai-Soldotna. And we're small, but we're mighty in terms of all of the things that we do.
One of the things the League has tackled as part of its mission has been to do policy studies on selected topics. Talk a little bit about that process and how you ensure that it is not partisan.
Exactly. We come up with an idea, and I must say the felon suffrage one was one. We've just finished one on school finance, in which we take a position on how school financing should take place in this state. We were part of the judicial review position statement, and when we start with an idea, a group will begin to study it. We usually have one member from each of the leagues, at least, who participates in that study. Once they study and come together with their consensus, and we do pro and con, because we do not take positions on candidates. We only take positions on policy. Once that's done, and we have a document that we're ready for the boards of directors of each of the leagues to look at, and then if they come to some idea that this makes sense, no, this needs to be changed, this needs to go somewhere else, then we open that to the total membership to vote on that, and then with that vote, we can develop a consensus of what we think about a particular issue.
And who uses these policy documents? They sound carefully constructed. But where do they go beyond the League of Women Voters?
Exactly. We do a lot of advocacy work, and our advocacy exists at two places, at least for the Juno League. One is at the state capitol. The second is at CBJ municipality. And when we have an issue come up that deals with one of those issues, like judicial review, like felon suffrage, like financing of our schools, then we will pull that right out because we've got tons of data that will support ours. It's not just some figment of our imagination. We have good, hard data that will support that.
We're talking with Dr. Carolyn Brown. She is the president of the local League of Women Voters. We have about how many members here in Juneau?
113
members. If you'd like to know more, check out the website junolwv.org. Thank you so much for your time, Carolyn, and your work to get people to the polls.
My privilege. Thanks so much.